Well, I too am grateful for the rain, as I'm sure many of you are. I didn't have to park in Arcadia today, given the Hysteria Festival that's going on. So the course that we're going to be teaching starting March 30th, it will involve Fuzz Rana, Ken Samples, and Jeff Swearink and myself. So you're welcome to participate in that on, I think it's Tuesday nights, right?
Wednesday nights.
Okay. Big Wednesday. That's right. So we'll be doing that, and it'll be a survey of apologetics. It's not going to cover everything, but we're going to kind of give you the highlights of apologetics. And if you really want to get into it in depth, you can join our cruise, 8-day cruise to Alaska, where we'll be having one or two lectures a day talking about the latest new breakthroughs, giving us new evidence for the Christian faith. And by the way, if you've never seen the Aurora Borealis, this may be your chance to really get a good look at it. The aurora always peaks at solar maximum, and this particular cruise will be less than a year away from solar maximum, so a good chance of getting a display. I haven't seen a good aurora display since I left Canada some 35 years ago. And when it's really good, it's like an all-night light show. Different colors, it's dancing all the time, and it's quite spectacular. It used to annoy me as an astronomer in Canada, because sometimes it would be so spectacular you couldn't see any stars through it. That's how bright it can get. So if you're interested, just go to our website at reasons.org. And, it was interesting hearing this testimony about someone studying history, because there's been several times when I've been on an airplane where somebody asks me what I do, and I say, well, I research and study ancient history. And they say, well, what do you mean by ancient history? And I said, well, I study the history of the universe. Forget about stuff that was 2,000-3,000 years ago. We go back billions of years. Let's really get into this ancient history. And I've had a lot of really interesting conversations that way. Because sometimes when I introduce myself as an astrophysicist, they get intimidated. If I tell them I'm an historian, it really opens up some good conversations. So whatever works. So thank you for that testimony. I might use that again next time I fly, and I'll be flying quite soon. I am going to have to miss that tri-tip celebration because I'll be in Pittsburgh. So I'll be praying for all of you here. What we've been doing in this class is kind of taking a little bit of a break from our study on Psalm 139 to give you the scientific support for what King David's talking about in Psalm 139, because that is a creation psalm that focuses on God creating and designing humanity for a particular purpose. David talks about how God's responsible for the origin of every human being. He selects the day of our birth. He has already put the day of our death on his calendar and all the events that take place in between. And we're the epitome of God's creation. We're the only species on the planet that's body, soul, and spirit. Other species of life may be purely physical. Some are physical and soulish. And that's the interesting thing as you go through the biblical creation accounts. Scientists talk about the origin of life. The Bible talks about three different origins of life. The origin of purely physical life, the origin of life is both physical and soulish. And by the way, when the Old Testament talks about soulish life, it's not talking about the spirit capacity of human beings. It's talking about God endowing the higher animals with mind, will, and emotions so that they can relate to one another, nurture one another, and relate to human beings, and how God has designed each species of these birds and mammals to relate to human beings in a specific way. And so, and then last of all, he creates human beings that are very different from the soulish animals. One of the ways of showing that God must be involved is the naturalistic evolutionists will say we're all here as a result of common descent from the last universal common ancestor, or LUCA. You always got to come up with acronyms in science. You really can't begin a scientific enterprise until you come up with an acronym first. But it's the idea that the origin of life was the origin of a single, very simple species from which we've all naturally evolved. But it raises a question. we have these birds and mammals that are not purely physical. How can the soulish come from that which is purely physical? Because the principle you see in science is that the effects can never be bigger than the causes. So how can the non-personal come from that which is, or how can the personal come from that which is purely non-personal? And how can the spiritual come from that which is purely non-spiritual? You know, and that's what we see with these three origins of life. Physical life only, then you've got life that's physical and soulish, then you have life that's physical, soulish, and spiritual, and the soulishness within the birds and mammals, and the spirit nature within humanity has no physical basis or explanation. But what we've been doing is simply looking at the simplest problem. You know, often we at Reasons to Believe will challenge evolutionary thinking by saying, well, what's the simplest problem to solve in your paradigm? And the simplest problem to solve is the origin of the first life form. Because all we're talking about is, you've got physics, you've got chemistry, can you put it all together to make the simplest living system? And the challenge is this, if you can't solve the simplest problem in evolutionary biology, then what basis do you have to think that you can solve the more challenging problems of the more complex life forms that follow thereafter? And as I've been sharing with you these past few weeks, it's becoming clearer and clearer as we discover more and more about the science of the origin of life that there is no possible natural explanation. And what we've been doing is looking at the problem of the origin of life on planet Earth and why, from a naturalistic perspective, it's impossible for the physics and the chemistry that existed on the surface of the Earth 3.8 billion years ago to be able to explain where the first life form came from. And that's now a consensus within the scientific community that there is no explanation for the origin of life problem in the context of planet Earth, which is what drove the excitement of going to Mars. And the idea was the origin of life took place on Mars, and then some meteor or several meteors transferred that life, Martian life, to Earth, and that's where life on Earth got started. Mars was the instigator. But as we explained a couple of weeks ago, Mars is even a worse candidate in terms of physics and chemistry for the origin of life than planet Earth. So Mars has now been cut off. And I think what really sealed the case was the discovery that Mars has 60 times as much sulfur as the surface of the Earth does. So much sulfur that it makes the surface of Mars so acidic as to rule out any possibility for an origin of life paradigm. And so now Mars has been abandoned, which is why they began looking at the moons of Jupiter. Moons of Jupiter were exciting for origin of life research because they're so very water rich. Earth is 0.03% water. Europa is 35% water. And I think it's Callisto is 65% water. And the fact that they're so water rich isn't surprising. They're far enough away from the sun that the heat of the sun doesn't dissipate the water. It's frozen water, but the idea is if you drill through the crust of Europa, you might find enough tidal heating from the gravity of Jupiter to liquefy the water. So the thinking was, well, maybe Europa has a crust of frozen water overlying a pool of liquid water in the interior, and if we can just drill through that crust and put a little movie camera down there, we can search around for the bacterial life that they're convinced must be there. But as we discussed last week, there are many reasons why there can't be life in the interior of Europa or any of the moons in our solar system. So Titan is off the map, Callisto is off the map, Enceladus is off the map in terms of being a candidate for the origin or the harboring of life. And now the origin of life community basically has abandoned the entire solar system as a candidate for life, which is explains this new drive for panspermia. And what was it? Just 2 weeks ago, we had this NASA scientist, Hoover, announcing that he had found life in a meteorite that came from a distant planetary system. And that's what he's saying, is that life came from some kind of interstellar cloud or planetary system. That's how life got here. Well, that's what I'm going to talk about today, is what about this idea of interstellar cloud life? I had a couple of hands I've been ignoring, so okay, go for it.
I think it's the origin of life. if you had to throw out a rough percentage, what percentage of origin-led researchers have been that to be the case?
Well, that's based, and you'll see this in our book, Origins of Life, how Fuzz Rana, our staff biochemist, and myself attended these Origin of Life research conferences, where they were, the conference, first of those conferences began with a review of Origin of Life research attempts to explain the origin of life on the surface of the Earth. And, you know, talked about the Uri Miller experiment of the 1950s. And what was interesting is Stanley Miller was in the audience. And you know, they were paying considerably. I actually gave him an award and all that for his research work. And then a lot of his students were there giving talks. But basically reviewed how as we went from the 50s to the 60s to the 70s to the 80s and the 90s, they progressively discovered that the experiment conducted by Stanley Miller was irrelevant to the origin of life. That we now had evidence that Earth never had the conditions that were simulated in the experiment by Stanley Miller and Harold Urey. If you haven't heard about that, it's the thing you see in all the high school textbooks. You've got this little flask, they throw some molecules in the flask, they spark it, and they get maybe 2% amino acids, and that explains where we get the building blocks for life. That was the story. And in the 1960s, you've got Sidney Fox saying, well, we can take these amino acids, and he conducted some simulation experiments where he could get a few of the amino acids linking together. And said, now, we're on the way to explaining how the proteins come about through natural process, and maybe we can do the same thing to explain where the RNA comes from and the DNA comes from. But what's interesting about this Origin of Life research conference is that there was these different camps. One was that the proteins come first and the RNA and the DNA come second. And there was the other camp that says, no, we start with RNA and DNA and then we get the proteins. Then another group stepped up and said, well, none of this is going to work if you don't have the lipids that make the membranes. And basically what they were doing in arguing against one another is making the point, it's not going to work unless you have the simultaneous origin of the lipids, the DNA, the RNA, and the proteins, and they all come together in such a way that the structures spontaneously give you the simplest living system. And a lot of it had to do with, you know, how simple can life be? And they were recognizing, well, you need an encased membrane, and the membrane's got to be designed so it can pull material in from the outside and export material out that you don't need, because after all, you've got waste products that are produced. So you need a transportation system at the membrane, and inside you need all these proteins and the DNA and RNA. And I guess what really surprised them was one scientist got up and explained where the different protein machines, the DNA and the RNA, have to be precisely positioned within the cell. The thinking before that was, as long as you get all the stuff inside the cell, you're fine. But he says, oh, no, no, you've got to organize it. Where you have them in precise positions, then you have to have transportation corridors inside the cell that move material from one molecular machine to another. And so there's a recognition of just how complicated life has to be. And then several people got up and talked about the homochirality problem. Well, this is all stuff we reviewed here a couple of weeks ago about why you can't solve the homochirality problem on the Earth. There's no way that the conditions 3.8, 3.9 billion years ago would foster the production of amino acids, the nucleotides, and the sugars. And moreover, we now know that the Earth never had prebiotics. We actually have chemical evidence that proves that planet Earth never had a mix of amino acids, nucleotides, or sugars. And then we actually were able to come up with some physical evidence. A Romanian physicist gave a talk at this conference where he explained why, from a physics perspective, the early Earth could never produce amino acids, nucleotides, or the pentose sugars. And something I talked about here, it's the ultraviolet oxygen paradox. If you've got oxygen in the environment, that will stop the production of these building blocks. If you don't have oxygen, ultraviolet radiation will stream through, and that will stop the production. And so, you know, you've got two choices. oxygen or no oxygen. In both cases, it rules out the possibility for prebiotic chemistry, and then we actually have the isotope evidence that tells us Earth never had prebiotics. That's what caused the origin of life community to throw up their hands and say, we give up. We know it can't happen on the Earth. It must have come from somewhere else. Yes?
There's a lot of original life can exist on Mars. It's the sulfur, but what about, you mentioned before about carbon. How much of that is in Mars or the Moon?
Well, what we mentioned, we talked about Mars, is that you've got a carbonate crisis. I mean, the thinking was maybe Mars at some time was wet and warm. If it's wet and warm, then maybe you've got conditions in which life could survive. However, because Mars doesn't have the plate tectonic activity of the Earth, if you ever have warm, wet conditions, that will generate a chemical reaction where the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which keeps the planet warm, carbon dioxide would be a heat-trapping gas. So if you have primordial Mars with a huge amount of carbon dioxide in its atmosphere, that would be adequate to keep the planet warm enough. But the problem is the carbon dioxide will react with the water to make carbonic acid, which in turn reacts to make carbonates. And when that happens, you're basically pulling all the carbon dioxide and water out of the atmosphere. And so you immediately turn the planet cold and dry. And because there's not the plate tectonic activity, the carbonates that are made by that chemical reaction do not get recycled back to the atmosphere. And so Mars becomes permanently dry and cold. And I also mentioned we have meteors from Mars that are very ancient, billions of years old. And those meteors tell us that Mars indeed has been permanently dry and cold. So on that basis, we realize that Mars is even a worse candidate for the origin of life than the Earth is. And also, it suffers from the same ultraviolet oxygen paradox. So Mars could have never had the building blocks necessary for life, which is basically why they're saying we must have gotten the building blocks from interstellar clouds. But we have another question here. Yes?
I seem to remember hearing that they found fossilized bacteria on Mars. Or did I mishear that?
Okay, you're going back to the days of Bill Clinton when they found this Martian meteorite, ALH84001. They found it in Antarctica. By the way, the Arctic and the Antarctic are the best place to go to find these meteorites because there's permanent ice there, and anything dark there probably came from outer space. So that's, you know, every year a bunch of astronomers go down there looking for these things. And if you chemically analyze them, you can tell where the meteorites came from. And we have, I think, to date, 22 meteorites that we know came from Mars. But one of the bigger ones is ALH84001. And about a decade ago, that was cut open. And there was a group of scientists headed up by Chris Mackay of Ames, NASA Center up in the San Francisco area. And he claimed to have found fossilized evidence for life in that meteorite. That got in all the newspapers, all the television shows. I remember Bill Clinton doing a little dance around the meteorite. He was so excited about this discovery. After 2 years of research, all those claims have been completely withdrawn. Those fossil structures are not evidence for life. They're evidence rather for non-organic chemical processes. These are carbonaceous type meteorites, and there's a significant probability you're going to be generating inorganic chemical reactions that will produce these tube-like structures. And for what it's worth, that's what happened 2 weeks ago when Hoover announced that he had found all these fossils in another meteorite that apparently could have come from beyond the solar system. So we have no proof that it came from beyond the solar system, but that was a suggestion. And mainly why Hoover was suggesting the meteorite came from beyond the solar system, because we've already ruled out the solar system as a candidate for the origin of life. So since this thing's got fossils in it, it must have come from somewhere beyond our solar system. But it didn't take 2 years in this case. Within 2 days, NASA came out with official statements saying this is not evidence for life. And they were very quick to jump on and say this can't be evidence for life. And I talked about here in class about the structures are too large and too numerous in the thing to be possible fossilized life. But now the scientific community has been quite quick to denounce this. And by the way, the announcement that the discovery was published in a peer-reviewed journal was highly exaggerated. It was published in a journal that sent the paper out after it was published for peer review. And within days, the peer review came back and said this should have never been published. So, anyway, that's the bottom line there. And that's why we're now looking at these interstellar clouds. Okay, in the back. Right.
Before the tides would come much taller.
Right.
And they actually had a scientist come on and revive the primordial soup for us, where he said the tide coming up and down the land masses created such an amount of erosion and mixing of chemicals on these new lands that created primordial soup. So they're not giving up.
No, they're not giving up. I mean, that was the thing that we noticed at these two Origin of Life research conferences we attended, is that the Origin of Life research community is dominated by people with an atheistic worldview. In fact, we thought we were the only two Christians at this conference, because after all, we were wearing our Reasons to Believe tags. By the way, we were well treated, because people appreciated the fact that we weren't young Earth. And a lot of them looked at our name tags and actually checked us out in our website and said, you guys are legitimate scientists. So they were actually very welcoming of us there. What was interesting is that after a few days, somebody handed us a business card and said, see me later, and gave us his hotel room and a time. And he basically told us he was a secret Christian who was in the Origin of Life research camp. And he said, you know, please don't blow my cover, but I'm just so excited that you guys are here. So there may be others like him, but a lot of them are convinced that, well, I mean, the problem is they start with a logic. Okay, we're all here as scientists. What do we know for sure to start with in trying to do Origin of Life research? Well, one thing we know beyond any shadow of doubt, there is no God. So starting with that, how do we explain the origin of life? So they have this presupposition that's driving them. And so they keep going farther and farther away. But I got a story to tell about how it really ended up. So go ahead.
What was this guy's name?
Which guy?
No. When was this Origin of Life conference? How long ago?
The two we attended were 1999 and 2002.
Okay.
And they're held every 3 years. And, you know, we've been wanting to go to these conferences, but the problem is, well, there's really not that many of Origin of Life researchers worldwide anyway. You know, it adds up to several hundred. And for some reason, they are now insisting on having their conferences in exotic places where the price tag is quite high. And I just couldn't justify to our board of directors a couple of us going on a boondoggle to this expensive resort in Thailand or China or whatever, where they were going. So we're waiting for a North American conference, or at least a European one, where the costs won't be so great. But a lot of them treat it as a vacation. You know, they have this conference and they have a really fun time together. But we're on a budget, so it's a little bit different. For us.
Follow on the question of, do you keep up with the proceedings of these conferences?
Oh, we do. I mean, there's a journal on the Origin of Life. So, the advantage and the reason why we went, when you go to these conferences, you hear things that probably aren't going to get published for 2 or 3 years. And since we were writing a book on the origins of life, we wanted to be at the cutting edge rather than waiting for the stuff to be published in the peer-reviewed literature. Let's hear about their discoveries before it's published. And what's really, I think, encouraging is that when we came out with our book, it really read like something that was 3 or 4 years ahead of the curve. And it's just because we'd been to these conferences and knew the research that was going to be published in the succeeding years, and actually got to talk to the researchers and say, what are you working on? And so they were actually telling us stuff that they were doing that they weren't even and they weren't even in the pre-publication stage yet. So it gave a good look for our book. But yeah, we're eager to go back to these conferences. But yeah, the stuff is being published. So we're keeping up with it. And if you look at our listen to our podcast or read our Today's New Reasons to Believe, you'll see that we're trying to keep up with the published literature there. But the published literature in that discipline is about 2 years behind the actual lab research that's being done. So it's not like that in every scientific discipline, but it tends to be that way in origin of life research. Yes?
Yeah, it seems to me like you would be in a strange place full of atheist scientists, because they kind of tend to want to prove or and then you come along and say, well, God did it. How does that go along with
as I said, we were treated well, and you know, even before they knew we were there, I mean, we had the first conference being led off by Leslie Orgel, and he was kind of the leading origin of life researcher at the time. And he gave a lecture on the RNA model for life, because that's where all the excitement was. Okay, if you've got proteins, you're not going to be able to put them together without the DNA. And if you got the DNA, you can't keep that going without the proteins. And so it's like you have to make them both. But then people were saying, we have found some RNA that can act both like a protein and like an information storage system. And so they said, this is a solution. All we need is one set of RNA molecules, and that can evolve into the DNA, the RNA, the proteins, and maybe even the lipids that could make the membranes. So there's a lot of excitement there. But I remember Leslie Orgel getting up, giving the very first lecture of the conference, and says, I hope there are no creationists here because of what I'm going to say next. It would take a miracle for an RNA molecule to ever show up on the surface of the Earth. So, Buzz and I wrote down his quote word for word, and you'll see it in our book. So, but I also remember Robert Shapiro, an atheist origin of life researcher, standing up there and saying, you know, given the status of research here, it's going to have to be intelligent design. I mean, we can't answer these problems, and we got nowhere else to go except intelligent design. And he said that right after there were two lectures that were just scorching against the intelligent design movement. And then here comes Robert Shapiro saying, guys, I know you're really upset about this intelligent design, but look where we are in our research. We're going to have to go there unless you guys can come up with solutions. And he says, I'm not impressed by your chemistry experiments. Your chemistry experiments are intelligent design. You guys go into the lab and you design an engineer. He says, marvelous chemistry. He says, I'm a chemist, and I'm very impressed with just how good your chemistry is. But guess what? It's intelligent design. And guess what? You're not doing very well, even with your intellect. He says, all you can do is put 40 amino acids together. And says, even if you put these 40 amino acids together, you can't pull the 40 amino acids off of the mineral substrate. It's like a glue. You can't pull it off, and if you can't pull it off, it's useless. So that's where he got the reputation, Dr. No. Pardon me?
How are you going to prove intelligent design?
Well, what Robert Shapiro was pointing out, he says, you know, if it takes more intelligence and engineering effort than what we human beings are capable of doing, then how can you possibly conclude this is natural process? I mean, natural process cannot do better than what we human beings do. And what we're seeing in these experiments is we need somebody who's a lot more intelligent, knowledgeable, with much more engineering resources behind them than what we're doing here in the lab. So he says, look at our miserable results and draw the appropriate conclusion. And, you know, we actually interviewed Robert Shapiro on our webcast. And he made it very clear, look, I'm no longer an atheist, but it would be appropriate to call me an agnostic. I've been forced into an agnostic position because I realize, you know, if it's pure atheism, these are intractable problems. But he says, I'm not saying it's the God of the Bible, but I'm kind of the opinion you're going to need something more than just straight naturalism to make this work. So he says, I'm continuing to do the research and see how this plays out. And if you guys are right, I'm okay with that. So that's kind of how the interview. You can listen to the interview. It's still up on our website.
It still sounds like the God of the Gap, so we don't know, so it's got to be that.
Well, Al, as I've said before, gaps are very important for solving these problems. There's always gaps, but if the gaps get bigger and more numerous or more problematic, that's a really good clue you've got the wrong model. You need to dump the model and go down a different path. But if the gaps get smaller and less numerous and less problematic, you know you're on the right track. And the problem I've been seeing, especially at this Origin of Life Research Conference, I mean, people talk to us, and I heard a lot of them saying, you know, I will adopt your Christian interpretation of the origin of life when you can get rid of all the gaps. And I says, well, that's akin to saying, I'm not going to marry this woman until I know everything about her. Well, guess what? No matter how long you live with that woman, you're not going to get to know everything about her. And by the way, that's what makes marriage enjoyable, is discovering new things about your spouse. And, you know, I've been married to my wife, Kathy, for 33 years. I'm still at the tip of the iceberg. There's so much below the water surface I don't know and understand. But the scientist within me is desiring to explore and find out more and more about my wife. Well, we need to realize that's true of all questions in life. There's always gaps. We're never going to know everything, but the gaps can lead us to the right answer. And the thing, reason why I press the origin of life with people who take an atheistic or agnostic worldview, I said, this is a place where it's relatively straightforward to figure out what's happening with the gaps. And that's one thing that came clear at both of these Origin of Life research conferences. There was a mood of despair over both meetings. And the reason for the despair and the depression was the recognition throughout all the conferencees that the gaps are getting much bigger and much more numerous. And yet they didn't want to abandon their atheistic worldview. But they had to admit that the gaps were getting much bigger. And they said, you know, we're far worse off than we were in the days of Stanley Miller. And there was Stanley Miller nodding his head. Yeah, you're right. It looked a lot better when I was a young man. So it's continuing to get worse and worse and worse, friend. That's kind of the story I'm telling. I mean, look how far away we're having to go to get the answers from a naturalistic perspective. We've ruled out the Earth. We've ruled out Mars. We've ruled out Jupiter's satellites and Saturn's satellites. And now we're asking the question, maybe it came from an interstellar cloud. By the way, there's a very good reason why interstellar clouds are considered to be such a hot candidate for the origin of life. It's the one place, the only place in the universe, where we're seeing a rich treasure chest of carbonaceous molecules. You know, I just went through the literature a few weeks ago. They have found 123 carbon-based molecules in these interstellar clouds. That's more than anywhere else we look in the universe. You had your hand up.
It seems like defeating atheism is a pretty easy thing because they don't have a model. But on the other hand, has anybody tried a God model? In other words, how would God have put the amino acids together? Is there any way that anybody could come up with a theory that would bridge the gap and say, okay, God had at least this much and then the rest happened naturally?
Well, that's a good question. And as I've mentioned, you know, we've been in dialogue with several different theistic evolutionary and evolutionary creationist organizations. And, we're asking those very questions. Okay, if God's responsible for the origin of life, then how did he actually pull it off? And asking the same question about the origin of humanity, which we're going to get to in this series, is okay. We agree that God did it. How did he do it? Well, what's interesting is that we have some biblical content that we can appeal to answer the second question. We have no biblical content or very little biblical content when it talks about the origin of life, other than the fact that the origin of life happened early and happened under hostile conditions, which means that, at least from our perspective, it's not going to be God working through the natural process. It's going to be God supernaturally intervening. You still got the oxygen ultraviolet problem. You still got the problem. You know, if God used a mineral substrate, how do you get it off the substrate? And how do you get up to, you know, 10,000 amino acids joined together and getting it to fold just right? And how do you get the RNA and the DNA? How do you put it all together? I mean, kind of where I'm leading you is this. You're going to need an engineer. I mean, that's kind of what these origin of life researchers actually are doing. They're coming up with these chemistry lab experiments where they're literally trying to put life together. By the way, you can read Fuzz Rana's latest book, Life in the Lab, where he tells the story of how, you know, people at Craig Venter's lab, probably one of the best finance labs for doing these kinds of experiments. He's got the sharpest and best of biochemists working on this problem, and they made some dramatic advances. But, you know, Fuzz's whole point is, you know, it's great what these people have been able to do in their chemistry labs, but look at the engineering effort they're putting into it, and look at the limits of what their engineering effort can pull off. And his whole point is, you know, we are created in the image of God, and if we look at the things that God has made, it's interesting we design things in the same way. So Fuzz's argument is maybe one answer to your question, let's look at how we try to solve those problems and realize God probably did it the same way, but he had a lot more resources available and he knew a lot more about the problem than we know, and so that's how he did it. I think he basically, you know, he had all the elements. The elements are there. And was able to kind of put them together and engineer them in such a way to get what he wanted. Yes?
I kind of think that maybe the word, in other words, is something in another dimension that science is not able to look at, which is how to organize information by speaking. Possibly God just...
Well, we've talked about that at Reasons to Believe, is that maybe God made the first life forms beyond the universe and transported it here to the earth. And if you go beyond the universe, then you're not running into all these problems that we're facing in trying to make life in the lab. The question is life that complicated that you'd have to use that kind of exotic physics to make it happen? Well, those are the kinds of the questions we're discussing. But again, we don't have a lot of biblical content to go on to try to narrow down the parameters. When it comes to human beings, we are a little better off. And also, because we're looking at something that happened, say, 50 to 80,000 years ago instead of 3.8 billion years ago, we have a better opportunity to try to answer those questions from a scientific perspective. But one thing the science can do is show that a naturalistic evolutionary pathway is not the answer to the origin of life. That's kind of what I'm trying to show you, is the evidence for that case and where people are going when they come to that recognition. Okay, yes.
Well, God apparently spoke to Moses and gave him the 600 laws and the Ten Commandments. I assume that's correct?
Yes.
Is there any possible way that God could speak to you and just tell you how this whole thing started?
Well, I don't think I've got the intellect or the knowledge, if he were to tell me, to really be able to repeat it back to you. So, it's kind of like what you see in 1 Peter, where he says these Old Testament prophets longed to understand what the Holy Spirit was inspiring them to write, but recognized that God was intending this for a future generation. And so we may not be mature enough yet in our scientific knowledge to really understand how God did it.
They may come where God could explain all this?
Or I could put it another way. You know, sometimes God wants us to find out these answers for ourselves, and so actually kind of leaves us alone to discover it on our own. That's a really good teaching tool. You know, I'm up here. If I give you all the answers, it may not be as fun as you finding out the answers for yourself. Okay, in the back.
I was an advanced matter atheist. couple of weeks ago, and I started trying to witness. He didn't want to talk about it. He said, I'm an atheist. Don't try to convert me. So then he says to me, he says, I'm a Darwinist. I believe in Darwin, you know? And I said, oh, so let's talk science. I said, okay. So he says to me, I said, so are you kidding? Darwin wouldn't even be a Darwinist today. I said, first of all, there's not enough time and there's no fossil evidence. I said, there's no fossil evidence for transitional forms. And it kind of forced him to think, well, I know there's gaps, but we're going to fill in the gaps. So they know their gaps, and it almost forced him to be on the defensive about gaps and truth. I was always on the defensive.
Right, right. Well, it's a whole other argument. I mean, I remember dialoguing with some evolutionary creationists, and they were claiming that the fossil record testified of gradualistic process all the way through. Well, they were out of date. The research is quite clear, and this is something that's widely recognized in the scientific community, is that we see discontinuities in the fossil record, dramatic discontinuities. That needs to be taken into account, and how well can natural process explain the dramatic nature of the discontinuities? That's not just one, there's many. Anyway, let me move on through this. We have found 123, as I mentioned, carbonaceous molecules in these interstellar clouds, and the most complex that have been found are up to 3 carbon glycoaldehydes. So those are the most complicated ones that have been found. But what's interesting is they've yet to find ammonia in these interstellar clouds. And that's a simple molecule. It's NH3. It's not that complicated, but they don't find ammonia. And why that's a problem is ammonia is crucial for every origin of life chemical pathway. If you don't have ammonia, that shuts down the production of these nucleotides and amino acids. The other thing we notice is we're not finding any sugars. And if you don't have the sugars, you can't put together the nucleotides to make DNA and RNA. Incidentally, that's true of the Earth, it's true of the solar system, it's true of the entire universe. We have never found, outside of life systems itself, any pentose sugars. The only place you find pentose sugars is in life or the remains of life. Nowhere else do we see those sugars. And without the pentose sugars, you've got no origin of life model. Now that, in my opinion, by itself establishes life could not have gotten here by a naturalistic pathway. Where are the pentose sugars? They're not there. Well, neither do we have the nucleobases, and we don't have the amino acids. What we're showing here is you're missing all the building blocks of life. The simple building blocks, amino acids, nucleobases, the sugars, they're missing. Now, I'm not sure they're going to be permanently missing, because when we astronomers look for these interstellar clouds, at best we can do is measure the abundance down to a few parts per billion. There are telescopes coming on board that will be able to measure down to 1 part per billion. And it wouldn't surprise me if we find these at that abundance level. Why? Because just based on the 123 carbonaceous molecules we've found, there must be some limited production of at least a few of the amino acids and at least 2 of the nucleobases. So I'm anticipating that astronomers will fairly soon announce the discovery of nucleobases and amino acids in these interstellar clouds, and when they do, they're going to claim they've solved the origin of life problem. However, finding these things of parts per billion is no help to any origin of life scenario. That's an abundance level that's so extremely low, it's literally impossible for that to be of any help to origin of life solving the problem of the origin of life. In fact, I would argue that just based on what we know, we must find them at a few parts per billion, but so far they haven't. Now, just to clarify things, there was an announcement 10 years ago in the Astrophysical Journal that they found glycine, the simplest of the amino acids, and I'm trying to remember which nucleobase they found. Again, they found the simplest of the nucleobases. However, about 9-10 months ago, both research teams published articles in the Astrophysical Journal where they pointed out that they had misidentified the spectral lines that they thought were evidence for the glycine and the one nucleobase that they had found. So, officially, no evidence for any of these yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if we come up with a nucleobase, and particularly glycine. Glycine is a very simple amino acid. It wouldn't surprise me if we find that, but I would, you know, be highly surprised if we ever find any pentose sugars.
Phosphates,
we do find phosphates. So they're around, but phosphates are simpler than these molecules. So, and by the way, we're not finding the phosphates at an adequate abundance level. The miracle of phosphorus is this. Earth is the only place where we see a high abundance of phosphorus. Earth has four times the phosphorus content of any other solar system body. And more than four times, far more than four times the phosphorus content of anywhere else in our galaxy. So planet Earth is the phosphorus champion of our Milky Way galaxy. And it's because we have so much phosphorus that it's possible to have an abundance of life here on planet Earth. But you know, notice we've ruled out the Earth as a candidate, which means you got to get the phosphorus from somewhere else. When we go somewhere else, we don't find adequate amounts of phosphorus. It seems to be only here on the Earth.
That's a good place for us to give thanks for planet Earth and moon
folks. Okay, all right. Well, the other thing I'll just close with here, we can't find any homochirality in these interstellar clouds. So even if we find amino acids, there's going to be no way to get them all 100% left-handed or right-handed. And as I say, I don't think there's any possibility for finding a pentose sugar, but even if you did, you're not going to solve the homochirality problem. But that, we'll pray. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for our opportunities in the 21st century to study these issues, to actually look at the gaps in our understanding and see which direction the gaps are going. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us and people we meet and discuss these issues with to really see the value of gaps for testing our competing models of creation and evolution. Lord, continue to shed light upon each of us here in this class, but more than that, help us to receive the light that you're giving us. So I pray, Lord, that you grant us with a humility not only to see the truth, but to accept the truth and act upon that truth. In Jesus' name, amen.
What would a homochirality source look like? I don't have it here.